You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 479.
You know what happened to the last time a group of people said, screw it, we don't care what they think? They got hung as witches. Eliza Schlesinger.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Indie Film Hustle's Filmmaker Process. We provide filmmakers with professional services to get their films or series funded, finished, and distributed. Some of the services we offer are pitch deck creation, film budgets and schedules, domestic and international sales estimates, legal contract templates, consulting, post-production services, script coverage, professional trailer editing, poster design, film deliverables, and production payroll. To learn more, go to www.filmmakerprocess.com. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success.
The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com.
Well, guys, today we have a special episode. We have Eliza Schlesinger. And Eliza is an amazing stand-up comic. She won Last Comic Standing years ago. She's been a headliner since she was 26 years old. And you know, I've worked with a lot of stand-ups in my career, from Gabe Iglesias to Joe Michelle and so many other stand-ups. And I've kind of been inside their world a bit. And they are a unique creature, as Eliza would be the first to admit. And I wanted to bring Eliza on because she has a very unique perspective on making it in Hollywood and the hustle and trying to break in and all the struggles that she has gone through throughout her career, and she's been able to come out the other side of this as a very successful stand-up comic as well as actress. She just was in a movie with Mark Wahlberg called Spencer Confidential on Netflix, where she was the co-star and ex-girlfriend of Mark, which if you haven't seen that movie, it's hilarious, and her performance is remarkable. And she is just a very raw kind of, you know, steamrolling kind of comic, as she stated in our conversation. And I think there's going to be some value here for filmmakers and screenwriters to listen to her journey, not only because it's funny, but we also talk about how she constructs a joke, how she works out material, how she talks to an audience. All these little nuggets, little gold nuggets that she dropped throughout this interview was pretty remarkable. And we talk about her new project, Good on Paper, which was bought by Netflix and produced by Universal Studios. And that's a whole story, how she got this project made. And the remarkable story of how this insane movie and story is actually based on real events, on real things that happened to her. So I won't ruin anything else. Without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Eliza Schlesinger. I'd like to welcome the show. Eliza, how are you doing?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. Like I was telling you earlier, I am a big fan of yours. I've been watching you for a while, and I've been in the stand-up circles for quite some time, working with a lot of big stand-ups, going on tour and with some of them, and they are. And my first, Gabe Iglesias. I did a bunch of stuff with Gabe. Jill Michelle Millan was the star of my first feature, and she introduced me to a ton of comics, and most of Deborah Wilson. God, so many different. Carlos Alzaraki, and then all of Gabe's. They were all in my first feature that I directed. So, the second I got to LA, literally 3 months after I got to LA, the stand-ups were the first to embrace me. And I just became friends with them. It's a wild ride hanging with stand-ups, especially at late at night in those comedy clubs.
Yeah, it's somewhere no one should be, but that's where we are.
Exactly. But one thing I always wanted to know, coming from a stand-up, how do you construct a joke? Like, how do you, as a writer, bring it together and then the timing and the pitching and the working it out before you get on stage?
You know, I'm a big believer in the workout, in just getting up every night. Sometimes you can't do every night, but I get up pretty consistently. And it really is about talking it out. You know, you will never know what it's going to be until you get it on its feet. So you can stay at home and you can write all that you want, but it isn't. And I think a lot of screenwriters too, unless you say the words out loud and you hear them out loud to hear the intonation and inflection and pauses, and then of course there's that audience feedback, you'll never know, because the way it sounds in your head, it won't even ever sound the way that you want to say it. So it is about working it out over and over. And then, you know, if you get a big laugh, great. If you get half a laugh, maybe you have to switch things around. You know, it goes beyond premise, setup, punch. You know, there's so right. much in between. And that really just comes down to the craft of it, which a lot of people forego because people want to get famous immediately, or they want the joke to just work. Or sometimes the low hanging fruit joke just works fine. You just made a joke. You said the F word and that was that. Not that the F word isn't a beautiful thing, but you know, about 10 years in is when you can really start to change and really dive into the math of it and the energy of stuff and taking people on that ride. So it's just like anything else. There's a craft, and you got to put in that 10,000 hours and just keep saying it over and over.
Yeah. That's the thing that a lot of even actors and standups, but they don't understand that it's a rarity to have a Eddie Murphy show up, you know, that, or you know, these young kids who just explode. And you were fairly young when you kind of became, you know, a headliner and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Back with Last Comic Standing and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you go from like working the clubs to like, hey, you're a headliner now?
I mean, in my case, you're right. So I did win Last Comic Standing. And in my case, it was like, and now this is what you do. But the truth is, you know, anybody could rent a theater and say that you're a headliner, you know,
right.
So having that 45 minutes to an hour of solid material. Ugh. And a lot of people say, oh, I hear a lot of like comics that are like in their nascent stages. They're like, I'm running my hour because it's such a point of pride to have it. I'm like, no, what you're running is a very loose 20 with long pauses for laughter, you know?
It's true.
So it's about having the energy and the through line to take people through that hour. And so that just comes from the practice. But you know, you can headline a chuckle bucket and you're not ready to headline the Beacon. You know, this is about an audience that came to see you versus an audience that won free tickets. And that's what those clubs are for, is working it out. You know, my first couple, you know, of headlining gigs, you know, you're just, especially right after the show, it's just like, you're a headliner now. I'm like, well, I better string together the 45 minutes of stuff I have, because these guys that I'm touring with want to bury me. And then it really is about what you do with it, and about how do you choose to get better? Or do you keep doing the same jokes, or do you keep, a lot of people keep doing the same jokes versus evolving. So it's all about putting in that work, I guess.
Yeah. And I remember Seinfeld, I think one of his specials, he just retired his jokes, like all his solid material. He just said, I'm done.
That's what you do when you're done. You know, everybody, it's a luxury to be like, I'm done. And then the next crowd, the next day, they have to hear all brand new stuff that's not fully worked out. Sometimes it's just a premise, no punchline. But that's what your like Monday through Thursday night shows at like alternative venues are for. You know, I'll get up with my notepad on like a Wednesday, and I don't ever say like, let's try this out. But if it doesn't land, I'm like, look, this ticket was $10. We're in an alley. I don't know what you expected. There's sort of that tacit agreement with the audience, you know. But if you're coming to see me at a theater, this is your night out. I'm very cognizant of people spending the money that they have. In some cases, that is their money. That is their disposable income on a ticket to see me. And I want to give them a show. So the pressure is less there if you're doing a quick set at the Improv versus a 4,000 seat venue. You want to give them a show.
Right. Exactly. Now, I know a lot of listeners listening think of stand up as a very glamorous job, and you get to travel the world and first class accommodations all the way around. Can you just please explain to them what it's like, especially when you're coming up with the selling the merch outside the CDs or the CDs of your album or t-shirts. And stuff. Yeah. Can you talk a little, because a lot of people just see the Netflix special. They're like, oh, they've arrived. I'm like, yeah, but it took a minute to get there.
Oh my God. And even, I mean, there's a lot of Netflix specials. They gave out a lot. Like even those people don't have that merch. Like you just had that special, but aren't touring. You know, there's so many ways to tour. I mean, to put it in perspective, when after Last Comic Standing, we went on tour and I was hand burning my own CDs so I would have something to sell. I don't even know what that set was. My first album that I recorded myself, hand burned the CDs. I don't think I ever sold it. I have a very specific memory of playing the Tempe Improv. And you'd say, that's my time. Thank you. And then I'd run out with my duffel bag and I'd put out all my own t-shirts that I brought with me in my luggage. What? And you've got, this is before Square, you're running a credit card thing, and then you have a Square. And then, I remember I did a guest set at Zany's in Nashville and John Reap was on. And I remember I went outside and he had two folding tables set up of like way too many SKUs of t-shirts, but he had like 10 different kinds of t-shirts. And I remember thinking like, that's when you know you've made it, when you have merch like that. And it takes years to figure out, because you got to pay for everything. And it takes years to figure out the best way to sell. And then you start paying someone to sell them. And then you hire a team. And then you hire a tour manager. And so, at the highest point, you're Kevin Hart. And, you're selling whatever, you don't even see it. And then, I started doing my own everything, schlepping everything myself. And I know that, when the pandemic hit, I ate thousands of dollars in t-shirts that we had prepared for the tour.
Of course.
And those are sitting in a warehouse. They've made a lovely condo for a rat somewhere. but you're still entertainers. So you're still going in through the kitchen, like that scene in Goodfellas, Beyonce probably walks through the kitchen. Backstage is my opener. His name is Hunter. He loves theaters. He loves the history of theaters and they mean something. And I'm like, I don't do sound check. I get there. I have someone do my sound check. So I arrive like 45 minutes before. I come in the back, the loading dock where the garbage is. I never see the front of the house. I never see the front of the theater, except for like in a car, you see people lined up, which is great. But like, to me, they're just backstages. They all look the same. And if you have a second when you're on stage to admire the beautiful theater, that's great. But it's even at its most glamorous, if you have a private jet, that's one thing. But these are early flights. In some cases, you do have to connect if you don't want to take a private plane. You are connecting through Atlanta forever. You're dealing with other travelers, other passengers. I do believe air travel brings out the worst. Like if you want to know what the world will be like in a post-apocalyptic situation, go to an airport. And in some cases, restaurants are closed or you don't have the healthiest options. So, God, there are definitely times where I'm like, I think I'm supposed to be more glamorous than this as I'm eating like a power bar at a Wawa driving to the gig. But sometimes the only way to do it is to drive. So it's definitely humbling, but it's definitely worth it because you get to do the best job in the world on your own terms.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, during all those early years, what is there an experience, the worst kind of experience that you had at one of these stand up, at one of these gigs that you just like, oh my God, that day I'll never forget?
I mean, there's definitely, look, because you can't talk about that without talking about being a woman in stand up, which it's never occurred to me that I always get questions about, and you didn't ask this, but it's fine if we don't talk about it, like, are women funny?
That was my next question.
Okay. It's such an antiquated question because it comes from this world where it was only men doing it. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, personally, it never even occurred to me, not growing up, not when I got into it, that I wasn't just as funny as my friends, because I was always funny. And so I feel bad for the women who have had to go through it, also because I became a headliner so soon. Mm-hmm. I never had to ask permission. I never had to seek validation from someone because I was always in charge. And that's a blessing and a curse, because you sort of miss bonding time with other comics, but I take it over, you know, some male comic telling me I had to like sleep with him or something, which is fully insane. So, you know, a lot of that comes down to physical vulnerability as a girl, and vulnerability, male or female or other, standing on stage, it is this tacit agreement with the audience that we intend to do no harm. So I'm going to stand completely blind to you because the room is dark and the lights are on me. And I'm going to hope that no one's going to throw anything, that no one's going to come on the stage, you know? I mean, there are comics who have had that happen to them. It's not like the movies where they're like throwing tomatoes. One sticks out because it's particularly egregious. I was on stage in St. Louis at a club. This is a very long time ago. And sometimes you get hecklers who just make noise. Like they just, it's like this male inferiority thing. Like they just want to be included. And I was doing well and everything was fine. And I kept hearing like a noise every time they laugh. I'd hear like, ooh. And so your first thought is, okay, either he's booing or he's making a noise because he's hoping I'll be like, who's that owl? Oh, is it you? Do you want to come up here? Right. And what I soon realized after was that he was yelling Jew every time I would tell a joke. And I was just, you have a choice to make, you know, like I do a very intense act and I grab him and we go. I'm like, do I want to stop down for this idiot? And then what am I going to say? Hey, don't be anti-Semitic. Like whoever makes that choice. So I went to the green room. Show was done. I was sitting there with my dog Blanche and the guy came into my green room and he was just like, hey, love you, even though you're a Jew. And then I just remember my first thought was grab your dog, like protect the dog who's fine. And then I like puffed up and I was like, get the fuck out of here. And you know, you slam the door. And then it's a good thing that it happened only because it brings, especially when you're a younger girl, it brings into your consciousness like, oh, I need to make sure even at a shitty club, like there's someone. It doesn't have to be secure, just a dude there, or there's a lock, or that the public can't get back to the green room. So you start to have an awareness of how unsafe it is. And it's unfortunate that experiences, whether it's someone invading your personal space or stalking you, you know, you have to pay for security. You know, now I have police officers there. We have everything because I have a stalker, and I've had, for the most part, it's been 99.99% positive, but all it takes is one person. Right. There's something wrong with them doing something. So that was probably the scariest versus like a heckler or the times I've dumped drinks on people or things like that. And so it's good to have that in your mind because when you're young, you think you're invincible and you're not.
Yes. Life tells you that you're not quickly as you get older.
You don't get a lot of those lessons as a upper middle class white person, but that one was particularly jarring.
Now, as a stand-up, did you always want to be an actor, or is it just something you fell into?
You know, it's one of those things where I've had some success with it lately, but it's not for lack of trying. You know, I've been auditioning for over a decade, and it's just hard, just like stand-up is hard, you know, and I always respect actors because stand-up, I can get up every night and practice my craft. And acting, you have to pay for a class. You have to get a group. Like you can run your monologue alone, but it is so hard. And I have so much respect for actors and that craft and the dedication it takes just to get a commercial, you know, and the amount of luck and stuff like that. So it's not something that I was able to dedicate as much time to as stand-up because stand-up just gave me more green lights. Not that it hasn't been difficult, but it's something where I've been able to get great auditions because I can act and I'm good enough at it, but it is very hard to get it over the top. You know, some people, there's an art to auditioning. And every once in a while it works out, and obviously more gigs beget more gigs. Mm-hmm. But I just always assumed I would be an entertainer across the board, minus the singing.
so we're not expecting you to do a duet with Lady Gaga anytime soon, is what you're saying?
Oh, I'll do it. I just don't think anyone's going to want it.
Fair enough.
I'll do it.
Now, can you tell me what happened when you got that call from Mr. Mark Wahlberg for Spencer Confidential, which, by the way, I loved you. And you were you stole the show. You stole the show. Every time you showed up, I was like, this is going to be great.
Thank you. I actually remember it. First of all, it was an audition like any other audition. The fact that we had both, I was in Instant Family, did not matter. I don't think you remember because it was like 10th on the call sheet. We just happened to both be in both movies. I auditioned just like any other audition and I assumed I wouldn't get it, just like literally every other audition. I did choose to do a Boston accent, even though the sides said like explicitly no Boston accents. But I remember reading the lines and thinking, you can't not do a Boston accent. She talks about like St. Francis. Unless you're Irish, you're not invoking a saint's name or Italian, but unless you're from Boston, like it's specific. So I went to school there. I took a crack at it. And I think they just didn't want to spend their day hearing bad ones. Mm-hmm. And just like, whatever. Then I threw it away. You know, you're done with the audition. And I was actually in Boston. I was there to do like a big corporate event. And I was just, I remember this specifically because they always say in LA, you know, if you want to book a gig, book a plane ticket. The idea behind that being, if you want something, just tell the universe you don't want it and it'll come to you. And I was waiting for my agent to call me back because it was like, oh, we'll know Friday or something. And she hadn't called. And I was like, this is so dumb. Just, you know what? You're going to meditate. I never meditate. I'm like, I'm going to meditate. I'm turning the phone off. I'm taking the power out of it. Turn the phone off. I laid down, I got through about 5 minutes and I was like, this is so boring. And I turned the phone on and I had a missed call and I was like, Jesus, fuck. And I called her back and she was like, Mark Wahlberg wants to call you. And I'm like, oh, that's so sweet. He's going to call me to tell me I did a great job, but unfortunately they have to give it to an octopus. And so she's like, he's going to FaceTime you. And I'm like, I just got out of the shower. Like, and I was like, oh my God, I can't look like this. So I'm like racing around to get ready. He didn't FaceTime, he called. And it was very, you know, it kind of took his time. And I'm just babbling about like how I went to school in Boston. Nobody fucking cares. And he just goes like, so, you know, we liked your audition. We liked your tape. I'm like, okay, like waiting for the rejection. Like I'm a pretty confident person, but like no one books anything. And I just remember he goes, so you ready to get crazy with us? And I actually went, I'm sorry, does that mean I have the gig? Because I have to hear you say it. And he was like, yeah, we'll see you in Boston. And I hung up and I screamed. I'm pretty sure they thought someone was being murdered in my hotel room. Because you only get a couple of those big wins in a career. And so that's – and then, you know, we got to have fake sex in a bathroom. It was very real for me, but
– Yes, I've seen some of your interviews in regards to that sex scene. And Mark, when you're sitting next to Mark, you're like, I can't even look at you, Mark. I can't have an eye contact with you.
It was the least intimate, you know, that we didn't even kiss in the scene. And it's like, hi, there's no lesson you take for like, hey, you're going to have fake sex for the first time on camera with one of the world's biggest movie stars. Like there's no tutorial.
There's no book for that.
And he's Mark Wahlberg. So it's not like we are colleagues. It's not like he's my contemporary, you know? So it's not like he's like a kid that I've known forever. And like, it's just, he's Mark Wahlberg, so you're just like, I need to remain professional and also like honor my husband, but also like, you know, like it's incredibly nerve-wracking. And there's no one teaches you how to act other than like just be as ice cold professional as possible about it while letting him know that that was crazy. And he's just, the guy works so much. He's probably like, oh, I don't remember the name. I don't know what movie we're doing this for.
Right.
So it's cool. It was cool. Like three pairs of underwear. And like sweating through that dress, so it was not romantic at all.
It looked quite romantic. No, I'm joking. It was an intense scene
for every woman.
Now you wrote a book called Girl Logic. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about why you wrote that book and what you wanted to put out there.
So I probably wrote this book 2017, 2018, and I just sort of, you know, a lot of my act for a while was about making fun of girls, you know, laughing with, not at, but also at, because everything weird that we all do it. And I believe stand-up is about holding up a mirror and being like, here's what we do. And then I sort of started getting more into the psychology of it and sort of, it's not enough to just make fun, but explaining why we think the way that we think. And we're so vilified, you know, women are so vilified if they deign to try at all, right? Either you're you've lost too much weight, or your body isn't perfect, or you're too proud of yourself, or you need a better self-esteem. Like, we like to keep women in this constant state of being unsure of themselves. And so I wrote Girl Logic as my sort of scientific, without any backing, take on explaining why we think the way that we do. And we're always labeled crazy, but there's actually a lot of heart and intelligence that goes into why we think the way we do. And we have to be so many things to so many people all at once. The expectation is you'll be the perfect mother. You'll be thin. You'll be curvy in the right places. You'll be a team leader, but also a go-getter, but also quiet, but you'll also listen, but not bitchy, but also in charge. And it vacillates depending on who you're talking to. And so it's so easy to label women as crazy when the truth is we are just trained from thousands of years of trying to be everything at once. So it was my attempt to explain, and I think it's a great handbook for men, why we think the way we do. And you have to take into account fertility and sexuality and societal perceptions and all of these things that make us the way that we are. Not crazy, but very complex. And so I wrote that, and I just got another book deal. This one's with Abrams, and it's not a follow-up. It's just my second book. It's called All Things Aside, and it's a book of personal essays, and it'll be out in 2022.
Nice.
And I'm just writing that right now. But I keep forgetting.
It's on my
desktop.
It's on my things to do. It's on my things to do.
Yeah.
Now, you know, out of all the careers that you could have jumped into, can you tell me why stand up? Because like you said earlier, it's not an easy journey for a guy, but specifically for women as well. Because I know a lot of female stand-ups. It's tough. Why did you decide to go down this road?
I didn't think about it. I just, you know, I was always funny. I always did improv. I always made my own movies. You know, everything was always about comedy. You know, like I was the kid in school. The teacher mm-hmm. would be like, do you want, you have, you break into groups. You can do an oral presentation. You can do a book report, or you can do like a video. I'm like, video, stay in front of class. We'll forego the information as long as I can get that laugh. And so, you know, then I went to film school because there was no such thing as like a stand-up comedy major. And I was always a student of comedy, but it was never really about stand-up specifically because I loved sketch. And I remember I got to LA and I knew I was going to be in comedy, but there's no roadmap. I didn't have family that worked in the business. I didn't know anyone. And I was like, I just got to get near it. So whether that's working in an office that does something creative, I was like, if I could just, you know, at that, you know, you're in your early 20s. And I just remember thinking, I just want to be successful at something in comedy. I probably very easily could have become a writer or mm-hmm. someone that did sketch or a producer. You know, it's all about where the energy flows. And I remember thinking if I could just get that stage time. And I remember taking sketch comedy classes, and I thought I sent in a tape for SNL. I think I gave it to an agent who probably threw it away. But I just remember thinking, how do you get stage time? I didn't know about the Comedy Store or the Improv or alt comedy, anything. But I remember thinking if I could just get stage time, then they'd see how good I am. And I had come from a semester abroad where this is so random, but you know, they would do these open mics. I was on a ship for 4 months, and kids would get up and they'd sing or they'd do poetry, and I would make fun of the kids on the ship. I'd make fun of the male-female interactions. I would just kind of do that. And that was based off of a one-man show I had written in college. So it was just me taking the little things I'd written, expanding. And I took a couple of those jokes. I got to LA and I thought, if I could just find a stage, then I'll be a star. And I saw an ad for a comedy class. And it was, you know, pay, buy our book, and we'll give you a showcase. And I was like, I don't want to do this. I know you either get funny or you don't. You cannot teach it. Sorry, folks. Right. And I did class and I helped all the other kids write their jokes. And of course, I just did not like the instructor. And I'm sure I was nice to him, but I was just like, what is this? And it turns out like I'd read the thing wrong and you had to get to level 2 to get the showcase.
Of course.
I met another, of course. Turns out it was Scientology. No. And I met another comic who was just a guy. His name was Tim. And he was like, you know what? You're really funny. Some friends of mine, we do a show at Room 5 on La Brea, which was above this restaurant called Amalfi, which doesn't exist anymore, if you want to come. And so he introduced me to this group of guys who just were doing a stand-up show, and they gave me 5 minutes. And then I met some friends and we became a friend group. And then I started finding, and then I started going up at the Improv, and then they made me a regular, and then the Comedy Store made me a regular. So it really was just, I just do my day job, and then I would just go out and do a couple spots at night because no one said I couldn't and no one cared if I did or didn't. But I just started moving in that direction.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You don't have to ask for permission. You can just go. And now there's even more shows than ever. You don't have to just be passed by someone. And so I just moved in that direction, and I never even occurred to me that I couldn't or that I had to ask anyone for anything. And then I asked my boss if I could leave to go audition for a show called Last Comic Standing. And he said, okay. And then I won. And I was like, I have to quit this job.
And I'm out.
And I'm out. But everybody was very supportive. And I didn't know anything about, I went to a really competitive, academically competitive school where you were never taught girls are stupid or girls can't, you know, a lot of my friends are lawyers and doctors, and I was a really nice environment. And some people, you know, might roll their eyes at that, but there is something to be said for bringing your daughter up in an environment where she is taught she is just as good, and it's never even a question. And I took that confidence with me to moving to LA. And so when you run into people who think you should kowtow to them or think women aren't funny, I'm like, where are you getting this? You know, I don't know why you're so smart. It doesn't even occur to me. It's just such like a different way of thinking. And we criticize women when they have confidence. I've definitely been criticized for that. I'm like, what's the other version, that I'm as insecure as you and I mean to everyone? Hard pass. So just go work on your shit, be nice. And that's all you can do, right?
I've never heard of an insecure comic ever. I have no idea what you're talking about.
I mean, we're all, slightly insecure, but
artists are in general.
We are. Yeah.
But no, but I've been around certain comics sometimes. I was just like, dude, like, come on.
I remember showcasing one time for something, and there's all these comics in the room, and it's always so exhausting when there's a comic who's like doing bits for everyone. I'm like, dude, we're all here for the same thing. No one in this room can greenlight your career. Why don't you save your fucking energy? We all need attention, but like, I've never walked into a room like, fun time is here. Like, just save it for the stage and be funny with your friends. You're never going to, you know, I love being around funny comics. I love people who are genuinely funny, but people who try too hard out of insecurity and then get angry. And it's like, just do a good job on that stage. And then even if you're a bad person, people will still like you because you're successful. That's the rule in Hollywood.
Now you said you moved to LA. Do you suggest people, like, I came to LA over a decade ago. You learn here a lot faster than you learn anywhere else. But for in the stand-up world, can you make it in New York, Chicago? Can you just do on your own tours, or do you have to live in LA?
I mean, if you just want to be a stand-up, I mean, a lot of successful stand-ups don't live in LA because we are taxed very heavily.
Yes.
It's really difficult to live here, but a lot of comics just live centrally. You know, some people live in Austin, some people live in upstate New York, or that's not central, upstate New York. But if you're successful enough, like Jon Stewart lives on like a farm in upstate New York, and he just cherry picks his gigs as he can. I don't know where all stand-ups live, but if you only want to tour, it actually makes more sense to live somewhere else, unless you're like always flying to Hawaii. So you can definitely, and there are plenty of comics who get really big in another city and then they come here. But you got to prove, you know, LA is LA, and you've got to, I think it's a diverse city, and you do run the risk of, if you stay in your small town, you start to cater to that audience and you don't open yourself up to a bigger crowd. And when you really start to tour, you just know people, while they are the same everywhere, like, crowds are different. So your LA specific comedy, your Chicago specific comedy may not play in London, you know, if that's your goal, or LA may not play in New York. You know, funny is funny, but it's always good to get that perspective and to get those reps in somewhere else. But if you just want to tour, you can live anywhere because planes go everywhere. I think LA makes the best comics, personally.
And you happen to live in LA.
Happen to be one.
Exactly. Now, one thing I've always found fascinating about the kind of like stand-up psyche is I was shooting a special, and I was doing a test, lighting test, and I got up in front of the mic. There was nobody in the crowd. And I just stood there, and I just saw the empty seats. And I freaked out. I'm like, I can't understand the bravery, the almost the insanity of a stand-up to just go up and go, I'm going to entertain you with my voice, singing, and I'm going to make you laugh for an hour. It's always that guy, like, I could tell jokes in a group, and I can kill in front of four or five of my friends, and that's fine. And I have that charisma, if you will. But you throw me in front, like, it's a whole other thing to do it professionally.
You are alone. And when you don't do well, you realize how alone you are up there. and there's nowhere to turn. And that's the thing that's so great about the OR at the Comedy Store. It's like, if you're eating it, like, there's nowhere to hide. It's not even a big enough stage to, like, go to the other end to see what that side's like. Like, it's, you know, a coffin-sized stage, and you're just, like, drowning in your own hubris. I need it. You know, I don't need validation in the way everybody needs validation in a different way. Mm-hmm. I love making people laugh. And, you know, them laughing at you validates that all the things that you thought in your head about being human are true. And we all need these things for different reasons, but I've never had stage fright. Some people do, some people don't. You know, a lot of people find it terrifying. And it's weird because it is one of the hardest things to do, to master it, not to just tell a joke. And yet everybody thinks they can do it, you know, and people have no problem giving you critiques or advice, or you're in a conversation. Someone's like, I work at FedEx. He goes, and by the way, feel free to use all this material. You're like, I'm good. Thanks so much. But it's less about, oh, your life isn't interesting. It's more like I speak from experience, and I really believe, you know, me using your FedEx Kinko's material, while I'm sure I can make it relatable, I like to talk about things that I am, things that I feel. Like, you're talking about a point of view versus co-opting someone else's point of view. It is this inherent need to have people validate your thoughts. You know, Seinfeld, you think about it, like, it's this, the show is about crazy selfish people.
Oh, completely. Completely.
And yet we all watch it. We're like, I do feel that way. Like, of course they take it to extremes, but it is about saying, like, here's the weird way I see the world, and people being like, I see it that way too. I just wasn't allowed to say it. I didn't think I could. So it's very freeing. And it's important, that validation.
Fair enough. Now, your new film on Netflix called Good on Paper. I watched it, and as I was watching it, I love that it's inspired by a true story. And then afterwards, I'm like, how much is this a true story? Please tell me, did this really happen to you?
Only the part where we kill him. Just kidding.
They'll never find the body, ever.
Yeah. We say it's a mostly true story based on a lie. And it is true in that, you know, I did meet and befriend and then ultimately date, only for a short amount of time, someone who ended up being a full sociopath. And they, from the day I met them on an airplane, it turned out they had lied about everything down to what clubs they belonged to, what school they went to, where they lived, everything. And it was just such an insane story, which I only realized through telling the story how relatable it is, and that almost everyone has dated a liar, or like, oh my God, my cousin dated a guy that said he was a doctor. I mean, there's podcasts about it now. There are, you know, I told this story a couple of years ago, but like Dr. Death, or what's that one about? No, not Dr. Death. What's the other one? The one with Connie Britton. Okay, fine, whatever. Thought my assistant would know. You know, shows about guys who lie. You know, American, what? Dirty John. There it is.
Yes.
American, to an extent, is about people who just lie. And we don't realize that it actually is, the world is replete with liars. And it isn't until you go through it that you realize, oh, wow, this happens to a lot of people. And so what initially started out as me writing the script as a form of catharsis and just to get it out. This movie isn't about revenge. I don't care if that person ever sees it. This became about telling a great story. That's ultimately relatable because of the characters and the situations, and that's funny and heartfelt. So what comics do is we take real life tragedy and you turn it into something funny, relatable, that is art. And that was the goal. And it's so steeped in reality. So even if you don't believe it, it happened, folks.
Like, was it just like that he just met you at an airport and it just took the opportunity there to just kind of roll with it? Because it obviously wasn't someone who was just like planned all of this. It kind of just fell on it.
I don't know.
Oh, you never knew.
I made up my own conclusion. To this day, I'll never know. Did you know who I was prior? Did you Google once we were on the plane? I think, you know, because there's different parts of the lie, but on the plane, he said all these things. And I think that's just their MO in life, because I'd weirdly heard from a couple of other girls who were like, I know this guy. One girl said he lied about one thing, one girl said another. So I think that was his thing. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong, we talk about in the movie, with lying to someone on a plane, because you're like, I'll never see this person again. Who cares if they think I'm the Queen of France? Mm-hmm. Probably wouldn't be flying commercial if you were. But then, you know, the kicker of the movie is this person was a liar, but our character ends up liking him for all the things he didn't lie about. You know, right. Kindness, intelligence. And so it's a real lesson for, because there is an archetype of person out there who's so insecure. And it's like, if you were just yourself, you'd have such a better shot. Because that can, like, you're always like, what's the goal here? That we die together at 80 and I never knew?
Yeah, like how long was that going to go on? Because, I mean, as anyone who's ever lied before, you know, especially in a relationship, you can only hold that on for so long. And he lied about everything. It must have been exhausting.
And, I was like, this is a crazy story. And it really poured out of me. And, you know, I just wrote it, and then getting it made is a whole other thing. But
yeah, how did you get it to, like, how did, like, Netflix saw the script and it's like, we're in? How did that work?
Oh my God, wish. I don't even know if Netflix, they must have existed at the time, because I'd already done some specials, but this was before streaming, like, original movies.
Oh, so this was, like, a while ago. This all happened to you a while ago.
I think this happened around 2015. I don't know why I can't do the math, but I knew this person when I was 30, and I remember they were at my 31st or 32nd birthday party. So this is now going back 6 or 7 years ago. And it happened. And of course, you take some time with it. You need to remove the anger, because we're very quick to, you know, be like, oh, a woman scorned. But really, the story is about a man scorned. This is about a guy who was so sad and incapable that he was like, I'm going to make women pay for it. So I was very delicate in the way I told that. I probably wrote this script, and this script really is a testament to, again, asking no one for permission and just doing. So many people have all these ideas, and it's like, put it on paper, write that script. Because people want ideas. They want something that they can produce, and it's hard to produce just an idea without something concrete. So I wrote it, and I gave it to my manager, and I was like, here's what I got. And so she, you know, you take general meetings. I take them all day, every day. And usually they pan out to be nothing, but I was in Boston, my lucky city. This was a couple of years ago. I was playing the Wilbur, like doing like 800 shows. And she said, we have a general for you. His name is Paul Bernan. He's a producer. He lives in Boston in LA. Love to meet you. So I looked him up. I was like, ooh, he's cute. So I put in some fake hair and I went down to the lobby. And I had a boyfriend who's now my husband, but I was like, still best hair forward. And we ended up just having a really great meeting, and we got very personal and talked about relationships and where we became friends. And he loved the story, and he said he'd love to make it. And my whole thing in this career is like, I just need a yes. I don't care who it's from. Like, I want that yes, and please let me run with it. And he did. And they got Universal on board. And I teared up a little bit when I saw the movie after the fight, like after we were done with it, and I saw it on my TV, and I saw the Universal title card at the top. Mm-hmm. Because that's substantial. That's not 15 production companies each pulling together $1,000. You know, that's it's like, oh, somebody believed in you, and
it's
they
the
were
show.
Cool.
It's the show.
It's the show.
The show.
And you know, but even once he said he wanted to do it, you know, then begins a year of rewrites, going back and forth with one of his producers who ultimately left, and then we got a director on board, Kimmy Gatewood, and then she took a crack at it, and I had to go back as the writer and undo all the edits that were made that I didn't agree with. And Kimmy was like, why isn't it this? And I'm like, that's what it should have been. That's what the amount of emails where I'm like, that's what I had in the draft. So she was really great about understanding my voice and tone and intention. So we do that. And this is a movie, you know, when you're a movie star or when you've got big Hollywood friends, you can pull in a lot of favors. And I'm very much the little engine that could. And we were like, you know what? We're not going to get anywhere if we give this to actors and we let it sit with it for 6 months while they read it. I'm a big believer in, like, trust an actor, give them the part. So she came up with Ryan Hansen, who played Dennis. I'd never heard of him. he came in, and I was like, this guy's good looking. He's like, I'm going to wear fake teeth. I'm going to dye my hair. I'm going to do this. Like he wanted to play a liar, which is cool. Cause most men want to be like a superhero good guy. And then the best friend character was a combination, an amalgamation of three women in my life. One of whom is my best friend who is a lesbian. So I was like, this character's got to be queer. And we picked Margaret Cho because she represents not only, you know, diversity and being gay, but also stand-ups. And I have a great love for that. And she and I play well off each other. So almost every single part in this movie, it was like a race between me and Kimmy, like who could give the more parts away to their friends. we gave a lot, because, you know, like as someone who's auditioned, I think of the amount of times I haven't gotten it. And I'm like, but why? This person is equal. There's no reason. People get so precious about these bit parts. I remember like I've read for like a FedEx delivery worker. And I'm like, really? Like you couldn't just trust me with that line in your movie. And so my best friend, one of the guys who plays a director in the movie is an actor, but he's my favorite bartender at our favorite restaurant. And I knew he was an actor. And I was like, why wouldn't I give him that?
That's amazing.
Why wouldn't we give our friends these roles? This is like, don't be so precious. We didn't write Shakespeare here. Like you can, if you're a working actor, you can handle it. So it was a real exercise in trust, and everybody did their job, and it was really cool to see that.
That's awesome. And then Netflix obviously came on board later on and.
Sorry. Yeah. It was months and months after we had turned it in, you know, like Kimmy did her edit. And then as the executive producer, I sat there with my baby and I oversaw every single extra cut. Sure. Like I was, people don't understand that, like, your jokes live and die by the editing. Mm-hmm. It really is up there with performance. Oh my God, yes. And you can create timing if the performance isn't there. But it also has to do with lagging. You don't want people to get bored. So I was maniacal about it. We turned it in, and then you don't see your baby for months. I'm calling my executive producer every day. I'm like, where's it going? He's like, Universal isn't saying anything. And then he called me one day. He's like, Netflix bought it. And again, it was one of those, like, fuck yeah. Like you only get a couple of those screams in a career. And I think I broke a window. I was screaming so loud. The dog was terrified. And
but you've already had some specials on Netflix prior to this, right?
It's a different department.
Really?
You know? It's a totally different department. And because you think, you know, no one says yes to anything. Nothing goes. And I'm thinking like we made this great movie, but it'll probably be like a free movie with a QR code. If you order a mattress, you can stream it on Thursdays, like something weird. And right. To have a company like that say yes, it was so validating.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. Real quick, you touched on something about timing. That is something, in especially in all comedy, if timing is everything. You know, it really is about timing. How, you can't teach timing. You can't, like, how do you know what timing is? You know, I mean, I've cut comedy before, and it's just like the stand up will be there and going, nope, you gotta give me one more beat there.
One more beat. Yep.
What is
feel
that?
It.
It's a feeling.
You don't know
isn't
it. You feel it. Like musicians, like they just feel it, right? Like it just comes out. You feel it. It's actually metaphysical, and it's nature. This is such a weird example, but your dog has perfect timing. If you've ever played with your dog, right, you like, ha, ha, and then they always wait the perfect amount before they attack again. Like it's on the right beat. I've always noticed that. Like they understand the rule of three. Right. There's something, Avogadro's number, what is it, the golden ratio? Like there's something mathematical about timing, about the perfect amount, like da-da, 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 da-da-da. Like there's beats to it. It's musical. And you either get that or you don't. And you can try to compensate for it, or you could do what I do where you just steamroll the audience with your noises. But, and it really does make or break some great comedies, and it, you know, even dramas, you know, the suspense, you know, the bad guy's coming,
sure,
stabbed with the knife, and he does it too soon. It's not scary, and too late, you're bored with it. So, you know, you can teach people to be aware of it, but it is something that you feel like when you're on stage. You take the audience really, really high. You're going really, really fast. And then you drop it down. And
it's an opera. It's like you're composing music on stand-up. And the great stand-ups, you look at their shows, and it's just constantly is like
that. And there's different ways, just like for singers, right. There's different ways. I was at the Comedy Store last night and Tom Papa, I was just listening to him. He's on before me. He has a very melodic way of speaking.
Like, right.
And then you do it there. And then you don't know. You know, some people.
Well, Stephen Wright. Jokes. Like Stephen Wright.
Sure. Or there's like a misdirect. You know, right. There's a tempo. Like Sebastian is very like, da-na-na-na, 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 you know? And you get on board with each person's song. So yeah, it is, it's math.
it's math and music at the same time.
Yeah.
And then when is Good on Paper out?
Good on Paper is out June 23rd on Netflix. We worked very hard to edit it to make sure that it moves. And, we're calling it a rom-con. It's its own genre. Romantic.
It's very romantic. It's very romantic, the rom-con. Now, I'm going to ask you a couple questions, ask all my guests. What advice would you give anyone trying to break into the film business today?
Don't do it. Stay home. Be a doctor.
Get a real job.
Math and help improve America. Do not do it.
Fair enough.
We're good.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the industry or in life?
I don't know that I fully even learned it yet. Slowing down is very difficult for me. And I think in slowing down, because you can still be witty and you can still be fast, I think there's also slowing down of judgment. And I think as a comic, you're very armed. You know, and especially, you know, being a woman or whatever experiences you've had, you know, whether you're the fat kid or you're the kid that was made fun of, their race or whatever, you know, you build up a bit of armor. And you never want to be caught off guard, but realizing that most people are not, and these are my battle scars from just being in stand-up and dealing with broken egos. Most people are not coming to the table ready to be mean. But having gone through my own experiences with how competitive stand-up can be, you start to think that way about people. And it's always an exercise to remind myself, like, this person likes you, you know, especially in this business, like the feedback you get, people judging you for things you didn't do, or, oh, she was really rude. And you're like, I didn't even see the guy, like, you know, people putting their insecurities on you. And it is a challenge every day to treat each person on a case by case basis. And sometimes even give people a second chance, even if they're rude. Because the truth is, most people don't realize how they come across, and all they will remember is how you reacted to them. Mm-hmm. And as a comic, understanding people and being like, that person didn't mean it. They don't know better. I'll give them another chance before I completely decimate them.
Now, you touched on something. Do you believe that there is this kind of like crab in a bucket mentality when it comes to comics? Because some are supportive. But others are just like, it's like this competition. And I just want to, from your point of view, like, what is it? I mean, look, we're all competitive, you know, like, you know, everybody, every director wants to be Quentin Tarantino. Like, I mean, you know, so, but also in certain areas of the business, they said, like, I know a lot of these big directors, they all help each other. They get calls. They're like, hey man, I'm having this problem. What do you think? And they're supportive, where I know that happens in comedy, but I've heard much more of that whole crab in the bucket thing.
I think. You know, think of the bucket as having levels, and success begets grace. And so, of course, you're competitive. And it's silly where they're like, eyes on your own paper. I'm like, how am I supposed to know what to audition for if I don't see other people doing it? You know, and how am I supposed to know how high to aim if I don't see other people also achieving that? But I think at a lower level, you know, no one's sure who's good or who's talented. No one's proven anything. So everyone's trying to assert themselves. But there is, you know, when you see big comics hanging out with each other, it's by choice. It's not because they're stuck in a green room, and there is a respect. And you don't get, I mean, you can always be nice to people, but I don't have a respect for a ton of comics. And those that I do, you know, I don't feel the need to outfunny them or to prove anything, because there's an ease and success, money, but success begets a little bit of that ease where you're always having to prove something, but it's less about, you start to realize, like, I was never in competition with that person. We're each going to have our own thing. And I, you know, the thing with women in comedy being competitive, people enjoy pitting us against each other. I've always felt my competition were other men, because we've always been playing the same venues. Like, when I go to a large theater, for the most part, it's other male comics. That's not saying women don't do it. Maybe just not there that month, but there's not a ton. And everybody is truly on their own path. And so everybody represents something different, you know, whether it is your race, whether it is your gender, you know, we all tick different boxes. So at a lower level, when anyone can be swapped out for anyone, because it's all about that 5-minute set, then you get, you know, and it's like, well, we need someone who's African-American. We need a woman. We need a guy. We want a middle America white guy. You know, you start to find that own path and no one can take it away from you because you work so hard at building that point of view, you know? And so it really, the harder you work, the more success you get, the more you become irreplaceable. But at the beginning, you are.
It's Thunderdome.
You can be swapped out.
It's Thunderdome. You know? It's Thunderdome.
Like, yeah. It is Thunderdome at the beginning, but you know, like, I'm sure everybody wants to be the best, but I don't think like Kevin Hart looks at Dave Chappelle like, I gotta beat him, or vice versa. I think they're both doing their own thing, you know? Right. And the truth is, the busier you are, the more validated you feel, the less you think, the less you're doing that scrolling, the less you're thinking about who you hate and who you don't, because you're so busy that you're distracted.
You're focusing on the work.
Figure that out.
Yeah, you're focusing on the work.
Focusing on the work, and don't allow yourself to be pit against it. I'll have that sometimes. You know, I said something about a female comic the other day and someone was like, oh yeah, she's a bitch. And I was like, no, I actually don't know her. And I'm like, why do you think she's a bitch? He's like, well, one time. And I'm like, you need to relax with that, because you're trying to get me to say I don't like her, but I don't really know. I don't like her jokes, but I don't dislike her. But I know I dislike you now because you're manipulative. So like, just always be aware of other people's agendas, or do what I do. Do your fucking time, crush it, and go home and eat a sandwich.
And last question, 3 of your favorite films of all time.
Goodfellas.
Nice.
Goodfellas. I hate that question, right? Because
it's just, it's not going to be on your gravestone. So just 3 that come to your mind now.
I'm like, I'm supposed to say like Shawshank Redemption. I love Goodfellas. I don't have any. I need like a good. Sure. I don't know if it's my favorite film of all time, but I watched The Wedding Singer on a plane last week, and I was laughing out loud. It's so good. Adam Sandler's so good.
One of his best.
Can I just leave it at Goodfellas? Because I had, in film school, I had that poster on my wall.
Of course.
And I actually, fun fact, people like cringe at voiceover as a device, and I love it, and I put it in my film because of Goodfellas. I had voiceover.
But not as many whackings in your film. Not as many.
Not as many as I would have liked. As many as I legally could have gotten away with and still call it a true story.
It is an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you for being so candid. And I wish you much success with your film and everything moving forward. So thank you for doing what you do on a daily basis.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks so much for having me. And I'm just now realizing I should have said all the films that were framed behind you.
No, those are all my films. So please read them and say that. But I appreciate it.
The only one I can read is Broken, and one looks like it says Edge of Destiny, but I don't think that's what that says. I can't read it.
You're close.
I should have Googled. Okay, cool. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Eliza, for coming on the show and sharing your journey with the tribe today. Thank you so much. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, please head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/479. And don't forget to check out her new movie on Netflix, June 23rd, called Good on Paper. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.